Taliban in early this year.
The huge financial and military losses in the 19 years long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the US believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A
few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Mike Pompeo's visit, a first for a U.S. Secretary of State, will legitimize Israeli regime settlements, despite international consensus over their illegality, warns Prime Minister Shatayeh. The visit is a way to legitimize the settlements that will create a dangerous precedent that violates international law, Shatayeh said on Friday, November 13th, as quoted by the Palestinian state news agency Wafaa. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by the staff of Middle East Eye. This article is published under the heading Dangerous Precedent. Palestinian Premier warns Pompeo over settlement visit. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh slammed U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's plan to visit illegal Israeli regime settlements in the occupied West Bank and Syrian Golan Heights, saying it will set a dangerous precedent. Pompeo would become the first State Department head to visit one of Israeli regime settlements, which are considered illegal by most of international community. The visit is a way to legitimize the settlements that will create a dangerous precedent that violates international law, Shatayeh said on Friday, November 13th, as quoted by the Palestinian state news agency Wafaa. Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Hanan Ashrawi and the PLO Department of Public Diplomacy and Policy, which he heads, have also condemned Pompeo's plans in posts to Twitter. After overseeing a shift in U.S. policy to full complicity in Israeli war crimes, outgoing Pompeo will visit an illegal Israeli settlement built on a stolen Palestinian land in Al-Biraya City near Ramallah in a bid to advance his personal political plans, the department tweeted. Hussein al-Sheikh, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement Central Committee, tweeted recently that Pompeo's planned visit to settlements is a challenge to international legitimacy. The visit represents a challenge to the positions of all previous American administrations, which emphasize the illegality of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, he wrote. Pompeo's visit to the occupied Palestine comes exactly 1 year after he said the U.S. did not consider the Israeli regime settlements on occupied Palestinian land to be illegal, putting Washington at odds with U.N. Security Council resolutions. The Zionist regime unilaterally annexed the Golan Heights in 1981 and aimed to annex the West Bank in July, before postponing the plan amid U.S.-led normalization deals with the UAE and Bahrain. Pompeo is expected to visit the West Bank, which announced earlier this year that it had rolled out a label named after him in a show of appreciation for his pro-settlement work. Last year, the United States unsuccessfully challenged a European decision to put a label on all products that come from West Bank settlements. The U.S. State Department has not confirmed Pompeo's itinerary. In a statement earlier this week, the department said only that he would visit the occupied Palestine and meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a regional tour. Our own David Miller, a veteran U.S. diplomat in the West Asia region, tweeted that Pompeo's visit isn't about Trump or Bibi's politics. It's about Pompeo and 2024, referring to Netanyahu by his nickname. Pompeo has made little secret of his aspirations for higher office and has frequently pointed to his support of Israeli regime, a major cause for his Republican Party's evangelical Christian base. Next week's trip would be one of many precedent-breaking moves made by Pompeo and Donald Trump's White House. In March 2019, Trump signed an executive order recognizing the Zionist regime's control over the Golan Heights, citing a critical strategic and security importance to occupied Palestine. The next month, Netanyahu announced plans to establish a new Israeli regime settlement in Golan Heights, named after Trump, called Trump Heights. In November that same year, the Trump administration said that it no longer considered Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank to violate international law, going against a broad diplomatic consensus. Prior to this year's presidential election, Pompeo addressed the Republican National Convention from Al-Quds, which his administration recognized as the capital of Israeli regime in 2017. Pompeo drew outrage from the Democratic Party, which lambasted him for using diplomacy for political advantage. About 450,000 Israeli settlers live in the occupied West Bank with access to more land than its 2.8 million Palestinian residents.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insulting the Prophet is a manifestation of the dark, savage civilization of the West. November 11th, 2020.
One cartoonist has done a damned thing by insulting the Holy Prophet in the language of cartoons. The issue is not merely that an artist has done a deviant and corrupt act. It is not limited to that. Rather, there are certain hands behind this incident. What evidence do we have for this? The evidence is that we suddenly find the French president and the French government supporting this act, and other governments support them as well. Therefore, it is evident that there is a network behind this issue. The issue is not that French art has declined and that it has fallen into such an abyss. Rather, the issue is about the policy of a government that is supporting this action, manifested through a politician's support for it. You say that a person has been murdered. Very well, you can express your regret and sorrow at the murder of that person. But why do you publish such cartoons in places where everyone can see them, and why do you support them? This is a very bitter and indecent incident taking place at a governmental level.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The issue is not that a mere artist or cartoonist has committed this act. The previous time that this happened, we also witnessed that governmental and political personalities embarked on defending and supporting it. Well, such courses of action have been repeatedly adopted in European countries and in the US. The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the US and European countries, but such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A recent forecast suggests that by the year 2050, the number of people driven from their homes by ecological catastrophes could be 900% greater than the 100 million forced to flee conflicts over the last decade. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Nick Terse Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Climate Refugees Will Soon Surpass Those Displaced by War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. At least 100 million people have been forced to flee their homes due to violence, persecution, or other forms of public disorder over the last decade, according to UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. That's about 1 in every 97 people on the planet, roughly 1% of humanity. If such war victims had been given their own state to homestead, it would be the 14th largest nation population-wise in the world. By the end of June, according to the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, an additional 4.8 million people had been uprooted by conflict, with the most devastating increases in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burkina Faso. Yet, as dismal as these numbers may be, they are said to be dwarfed by people displaced by another signature story of our time, climate change. Already shocking numbers have been put to flight by fires and superstorms, and so much worse is yet to come, according to experts. A recent forecast suggests that by the year 2050, the number of people driven from their homes by ecological catastrophes could be 900% greater than the 100 million forced to flee conflicts over the last decade. Women, children, and men driven from their homes by conflict have been a defining feature of modern warfare. For almost a century now, combat correspondents have witnessed such scenes again and again. The Second World War was a cataclysmic conflagration involving 70 nations and 70 million combatants. Fighting stretched across three continents in unparalleled destructive fury, including terror bombing, countless massacres, two atomic attacks, and the killing of 60 million people, most of them civilians. an unprecedented global war causing unimaginable suffering, it nonetheless left far fewer people homeless than the 79.5 million displaced by conflicts and crises as 2019 ended. How can violence displace people already exceed the Second World War's total by almost 20 million without even counting the nearly 5 million more added in the first half of 2020? Today, according to UNHCR, ever fewer war refugees and IDPs are able to rebuild their lives. In 1990s, an average of 1.5 million refugees were able to return home annually. For the last 10 years, that number has dropped to around 385,000. Today, about 77% of the world's refugees are trapped in long-term displacement situations thanks to forever wars like the conflict in Afghanistan that, in its multiple iterations, is now in its sixth decade. One of the most dramatic drivers of displacement over the last 20 years, according to researchers from Brown University's Cost of War project, has been that conflict in Afghanistan and the seven other most violent wars the U.S. military has launched or participated since 2001. In the wake of September 11th incidents and the decision of George W. Bush administration to launch a global war on terror, conflicts the United States initiated, escalated, or participated in, specifically in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, the Philippines, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, have displaced between 37 million and 59 million people. While U.S. troops have also seen combat in Burkina Faso and Washington has pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into that country, its displaced aren't even counted in the cost of war tally. And yet, there is a clear link between the U.S.-backed overthrow of Libya's autocrat Muammar Gaddafi in 2011 and Burkina Faso's desperate state today. Ever since the West assassinated Gaddafi, and I'm conscious of using that particular word, Libya has been completely destabilized. Sherif Sy, Burkina Faso's defense minister, explained in a 2019 interview. While at the same time it was the country with the most guns, it has become an arms cache for the region. Those arms helped destabilize neighboring Mali and led to 2012 coup by U.S.-trained officer. 2 years later, another U.S.-trained officer seized power in Burkina Faso during a popular uprising. This year, yet another U.S.-trained officer overthrew yet another government in Mali. All the while, terrorist attacks have been ravaging the region. The Sahel has been the most dramatic escalation of violence since mid-2017, according to a July report by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, a Defense Department research institution. In 2005, Burkina Faso didn't even warrant mention in the Africa Overview section of the State Department annual report on terrorism. Still, more than 15 separate American security assistance programs were brought to bear there, about $100 million in the last 2 years alone. Meanwhile, militant violence in the country has skyrocketed from just three attacks in 2015 to 516 in the 12 months from mid-2019 to mid-2020, according to the Pentagon's Africa Center. The violence in Burkina Faso has led to a cascade of compounding crises. Around 1 million Burkinabe are now displaced, a 1,500% increase since last January, and the number only keeps rising. So do the attacks and the fatalities. And this is just the beginning, since the Burkina Faso finds itself on the front lines of yet another crisis, a global disaster that's expected to generate levels of displacement that will dwarf today's historic figures. Burkina Faso has been battered by desertification and environmental degradation since at least 1960s. In 1973, a drought led to the death of 100,000 people there and in five other nations of the Sahel. Severe drought and hunger struck again in mid-1980s, and aid agencies began privately warning that those living in the north of the country would need to move southward as farming became ever less feasible. By the early 2000s, despite persistent droughts, the cattle population of the country had doubled, leading to increasing ethnic conflict between Mossi farmers and Fulani cattle herders. The war now tearing the country apart largely divides along those same ethnic lines. As the decade wore on, rising temperatures and new rainfall patterns, droughts followed by flash floods, increasingly drew farmers from their villages, while desertification swelled the populations of urban centers. In a report published earlier this year, William Kemley of Global Protection Cluster, a network of non-governmental organizations, international aid groups, and United Nations agencies, noted that in Burkina Faso, climate change is crippling livelihoods, exacerbating food insecurity, and intensifying armed conflict and violent extremism. Sitting at the edge of the Sahara Desert, the country has long faced ecological adversity that's only worsening as the front lines of climate change steadily spread across the planet. Forecasts now warn of increasing ecological disasters and resource wars, supercharging the already surging phenomenon of global displacement. According to a recent report by the Institute for Economics and Peace, a think tank that produces annual global terrorism and peace indices, 2 billion people already face uncertain access to sufficient food, a number set to jump to 3.5 billion by 2050. Another 1 million live in countries that do not have the current resilience to deal with the ecological changes that are expected to face in the future. The report warns that the global climate crisis may displace as many as 1.2 billion people by 2050. Burkina Faso can't deal with the 1 million people already displaced by conflict, and the world can't deal with the almost 80 million people already driven from their homes by violence. So, how will we cope with 1.2 billion people, nearly the population of China or India, likely to be displaced by climate-driven conflicts, water wars, increasing ecological devastation, and other unnatural disasters in the next 30 years? In the decades ahead, ever more of people will find themselves on roads like the one to affected countries, running from the devastation of raging wildfires or uncontrolled floodwaters, successive hurricanes or supercharged cyclones, withering droughts, spiraling conflicts, or the next life-altering pandemic.
the debate.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kavita Lee. Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. This spells just one side of the story behind Sudan's normalization deal with Israel. What about other Arab countries? Were they also pressured by the U.S. into normalizing ties with Israel? What did they have to give up, and what did they get in return? And what about the rights of Palestinians? Whatever happened to that? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Debate. First, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo. He was the person who actually interviewed the information minister to bring us that exclusive coverage and the revelation of the facts. So, Ahmed, tell us about the interview and, of course, what you discovered.
Yeah, to be honest, he gave a very frank interview, much more frank than I was anticipating. And he essentially admitted that Sudan was blackmailed into this decision. He said, from when the transitional government took power, they began negotiating with the US to delist Sudan as a state sponsor of terror. And from day one, they made it clear to the US that it had nothing to do with Israel and nothing to do with normalizing ties with Israel. And the US allegedly agreed to those conditions. And it was just merely a couple of weeks before the election, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, changed his mind and said that no, it had to be the principal condition. And if they wanted the state sponsor of terror designation lifted, they had to normalize relations with Israel, which left the transitional government in a very tricky position because the economy was flatlining. The economic minister said that the economy wouldn't last 7 months. So they had to assess their options, and they thought, shall we gamble on a Joe Biden administration? And then they thought, if they gamble on a Joe Biden administration, the problem is that it'll take another 7 months coming with a fact-finding mission, and they might reach the same conclusion. So they were forced to accept a decision that they did not want to due to the economic pressure in Sudan, due to the long queues for fuel, the bread, and the economic crisis that's currently riddling the country.
So basically from what you're saying is the fact that you had Mike Pompeo that came and gave a different type of approach to the whole scenario, of which I'm assuming that is where you have used the word blackmail, which is indeed what actually transpired based on the way that Pompeo made his request from Sudan. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yes, and I asked the minister if he felt that the United States were using the economic situation in Sudan to leverage Sudan to normalize relations with Israel. Now, he gave a diplomatic answer, but if you read between the lines, he essentially admitted that, yes, they knew we were struggling, they knew we had no other options, and they knew that we were going to accept this deal because there was nowhere else for our economy to go.
Okay, very well. Let me now bring in our guest to discuss this a little bit further. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joins us from Vancouver. Khaled Barakat, welcome. Our reporter there, Ahmed Caballo, who traveled to Sudan and gave us that interview, of which we came up with this revelation now, which is the topic of our debate, amongst other issues that we're going to discuss. First, let me get a reaction from you of how you think that the U.S. actually used or pressured Sudan into this, of which, as our reporter said, Michael Pompeo, to actually to move forward in a blackmail-type scenario in order to get the normalization deal out of Sudan with Israel.
That is an excellent question, and I think that the U.S. always put pressure on states in order to normalize relationship with Israel. It's not just Sudan. In this case, we know more information because of this interview and also other reports that have indicated clearly that Sudan was pressured into this relationship with Israel. But even some of the Arab reactionary regimes, but they are pressured in a different way. Still, that, you know, they're trying to spread the fear in the Arab world that Israel will protect you from Iran, which is a false statement, and also trying to prove or, you know, tell all states in the area that the only way to you to get to the White House and a normal relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Tel Aviv. Basically, if you want to normalize your relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Israel as their allies in the region. Pressure always have been used, sometimes economic pressure, sometimes political pressure. And one of these ways is especially with illegitimate regimes and governments that, you know, this card, the U.S. could use it anytime. We know that today, for example, Israel have military bases in Africa, in some of the islands along the Red Sea, and this also exerts military pressure. Some of its nuclear submarines are roaming in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. So all of these factors are, you know, just normal, understanding and general wisdom of the people of the area. If it's up to people and even states, if it's up to them, you know, they will not normalize with Israel.
Anna Caballo, you know, when we take a look at the situation in Sudan, prior to that, of course, you had its former president that was there. But, you know, there was a point way back when Sudan had pretty much adamantly stated that it will not have any relationship with Israel, that it would not normalize ties with Israel. And this obviously requires a history check. At what point did the U.S., and I'm guessing along with Israel, feel like there was now an opportunity in order to move forward and make this request or demand, or should I say blackmail, Sudan into this? I mean, could you give us a little bit of a rundown there if you can?
That's a great question. In my analysis, it was when the Saudi-UAE faction of the military dictatorship took over. So within the military apparatus, there is a split between the Muslim Brotherhood-aligned factions and the Saudi-UAE-aligned factions. And what happened when Omar al-Bashir was overthrown in April was that Hemeti and Burhan, who were aligned to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they took control of the military and became the most powerful men in the country. And when that happened, it became clear that normalizing with Israel was again on the cards, because Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, of course, more keen with relations with Israel than, say, the Brotherhood bloc. And that is when they saw this opportunity. So it was also the fact that Sudan has been considered a pariah state for a long time. And the only way to get access to Washington, as my colleague just mentioned, was to prove to Washington that it now was a reliable client state. And by normalizing relations with Israel, it proves to Washington that Sudan can once again be trusted as a source of influence in the region. Because before that, if we remember in the 90s, Omar al-Bashir had very close relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now it's quite clear that it's distanced itself from the Islamic Republic of Iran and is very much in the Saudi-Emirati axis.
Okay. Well, Khalid Barakat, we know that this deal has come weeks after the similar moves that were made by the United Arab Emirates and also Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. The two have become now the first to recognize Israel in 26 years. Tell us whether you think what type of pressure was exerted on them to come out and make the announcement and to formalize this, even though, of course, it's been said that they have had a relationship with Israel behind the scenes.
Well, in principle, there is a camp that is led by the United States and Israel and the Arab reactionary regimes, especially regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others. And we need to remember that this camp have an alliance that goes back way back, even to 2012. In a real way, but there is always a secret doors and relationships between these regimes and Israel. Every couple of months, we see a new report that date back these relationships to even after 1967 war. We have to remember that after the 1967 occupation and aggression that Israel launched, Sudan, for example, was the capital that declared no reconciliation, no recognition, and no relationship with Israel. And so for them, Sudan is kind of more of a sentimental, more of a relationship than United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And later on, you know, down the line, the Saudis are going to come along also and normalize the relationship. But Saudi Arabia, you know, that's the big chunk in the peace that Israel is looking at. And the most important thing to remember is that this kind of policies, it is used on the basis of the carrot and the stick. So either, you know, these regimes are getting the carrots or they are get the stick. And basically because they don't have any sense of legitimacy in the country. So, for example, they cannot do that with Tunisia, for example, because we have an elected president in Tunisia. We have a public opinion, very strong political movement, anti-normalization in Tunisia. So they will not be able to pressure Tunisia because it is, it has a democratic institution. But these Arab regimes, they lack these legitimacy. They depend very much on the protection of the United States and now Israel.
Very well. Let me bring in Michael Lane now. He's a political analyst who joins us from Washington, D.C., to bring him into the conversation. Michael Lane, welcome. So let me first get a reaction from you. You know, we have got information firsthand that Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with Israel. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, when you look at the timing of these successes, it was something that the Trump administration had been working toward for a number of years. It was part of their strategy to follow down this route. But when you had three countries, all of whom decided that they were going to play this card and normalize relationships with Israel in the just several months and in some cases only weeks leading up to the election, it was something that the Trump administration worked very, very hard on the timing and getting them to fall before the election rather than after the election. I wouldn't be surprised to hear widespread reports at some time that the Trump administration was pressuring any number of countries to take this step before the election.
When you talk about the U.S. placing pressure, i.e. Donald Trump placing that pressure perhaps, then you know, there could be an observation on that, that there's an or else, meaning a precondition. For example, do you think that there was a precondition set here, as our reporter indicated, through the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who said that if you want to be taken off the terror list, you have to make this formal, the normalization with Israel. Do you think that that was the case?
You know, there are a number of techniques and tools that the United States would use, the Trump administration or any administration for that matter, the State Department, that they would use in dealing with our both our allies, our friends, and our adversaries in terms of influencing them to do things that we would like to see influenced. So, you know, would it be an exact quid pro quo, if you do A, then we will do or allow B? It would surprise me if that was used in many circumstances. I can't confirm that it was used in these circumstances. We simply don't know. On the other hand, it might be more general talk about, okay, well, you know, we provide so much in foreign aid to y'all, and, you know, if you would like to see that foreign aid continue at that level or even increase, then we would like to see some cooperation on some things that are important to us. On the other hand, if you can't see your way clear to cooperating on this one particular issue that's important to us, we can't guarantee that Congress will continue to do the foreign aid funding at the same level that it has. Some of the threats can be more direct and more overt than others. Sometimes they can be extraordinarily subtle, but the message still gets across that we are friends, we share a similar point of view. This is one of the things on which we really want you to share our point of view, and there will be rewards, there carrots and or sticks as we go through, depending on how much of our point of view you share.
Okay, let's talk about the stick. That's important. Khalid Barakat. I mean, when we take a look at the way that the U.S. may have pressured countries like Sudan, like the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, or with the UAE, how far do you think the U.S. actually pressured them into coming out, making sure that this is something that needs to be out in the open, this so-called normalization with Israel? I mean, do you think that the U.S. exerted a lot of pressure on them in order for this to, again, be out in the open? And also at the same time, I know it's two questions in one, we have to talk about the Palestinian concern here, the topic of Palestine. It doesn't seem to be the number one priority when it comes to the so-called normalization of ties when it comes to these countries.
Well, you have to remember that the mere existence of these regimes depends on the protection of the United States and now the United States and Israel. We also need to remember that these regimes are not really reflecting the will and the sentiment and the position of the people in the country. We know, for example, the regime of Bahrain. This is a regime that absolutely lack all forms of legitimacy in Bahrain. The people of Bahrain, the vast majority of the people of Bahrain, has been engaged in peaceful demonstrations and uprising, and they have been brutalized by this regime. And so the ruling class of Bahrain wants to protect its interest and its wealth by associating itself with the United States and Israel now, because it's closer. Also, it allures them the fact that the Palestinians are not in their best shape, and that Palestinians are weak, and they look at the Palestinian angle and they see that there will be no reaction, real reaction by Palestinian leadership and Palestinian factions, and therefore nothing will deter these regimes from going into more and more public relationship with Israel. And this is not really normalizing relationship with Israel. This is really building an alliance between, you know, the Zionist colonization state of Israel and these reactionary Arab regimes. One of the things that we need to remember, that the Palestinian factor here is a determining factor. If Palestinians get their internal affairs in place and they take a real and loud position, that will, in my view, deter these Arab reactionary regimes. Nothing else will do. They're not, a democratic governments. They're not governments that represent the will of the people, and therefore, why would they listen to Palestinians if they're not listening to the people of Bahrain? 95% of the people of Bahrain said no to normalization. This is the vast majority of the people of Bahrain. And that goes the same in Saudi Arabia and Emirates. If you will conduct a real poll amongst the people of the region, they are against this relationship with Israel.
Okay, so Michael Lane, the Palestinian issue, can you please tell us how the U.S. is approaching that in terms of the rank and the importance that it has when it comes down to these countries that are saying that it has to come out and normalize ties with Israel? I mean, is it trying to tell Palestinians, we're just going to have countries come on board, whether you like it or not, they're announcing their normalization with Israel, and therefore you have to, for example, succumb to the terms of this so-called deal of the century, which at this point is now kind of... it's at a critical juncture because you have possibly an outgoing president, Trump, along with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. But do you think that that's the approach that the U.S. is using in order to convince the Palestinians that you don't have a choice now because these countries are coming on board?
I think so, yes, if I understand the question. Look, Trump, when he announced the deal of the century and then sort of moved forward with it, had the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem, et cetera, was still trying to get Palestinian President Abbas on the phone. And Abbas hadn't talked to him for months, perhaps as much as 2 years. I forget the exact timing on this. And when that whole thing was started, and Abbas was still refusing to discuss anything with President Trump or with his representatives, the president finally said, okay, well, we're moving ahead with this. This is what we're doing. And I'm going to leave a window open here. The window is 4 years for the Palestinians to decide that they want to come back, talk with us about what they think this agreement should look like. And there was still the door open for some modifications in it, although once it was announced and once it has passed a year, those modifications become extremely difficult to make.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. I've got to jump in here, Michael, and I do apologize. I'm going to bring in Khaled Barakat with the final question in less than a minute, if you can, Khaled Barakat. Our guest there neglects to say that Israel in the past 4 years has continued with its violations of the Palestinian territories, even though the normalization of ties with the UAE, it said that it was going to freeze at least the settlement expansion, but it didn't. Do you think that right now with an outgoing U.S. president that this so-called deal of the century is going to fall flat and not go anywhere? Less than a minute.
Well, I mean, Biden is committed to keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. There is not going to be a lot of changes between Biden and Trump in essence, in real essence. There will be a different language used, absolutely. I know that the Palestinian Authority for sure are, clapping for Biden, and they're happy about Biden that Trump is gone now. But I don't think that any real substantial changes that Biden will bring to Palestinians.
Okay.
The only way for Palestinians to move forward is to have an alternative Palestinian revolutionary path.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our reporter at the top of the hour at the debate, Ahmed Kabayo, who spoke to us, who brought us that exclusive interview. Thank you so much, Ahmed.